The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky. This week on the show, we mark a decade of Google Maps and ask where mapping technologies came from and are going in the digital age. Joining me in the studio to discuss Google Maps and more are the Guardian's tech reporters Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
You managed to find your way here without the use of a map.
Just about.
Also, we're joined down the line by Gary Gale from the UK's Ordnance Survey to discuss their initiatives around digital maps. And we will be speaking with Professor Mark Graham from the Oxford Internet Institute and also of the mapping initiative floatingsheep.org, which is actually a really good site. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. In 2004, two Danish brothers approached Google with the idea of an app that allowed the user to search and scroll through zoomable maps. The nascent search engine giant liked the idea so much they bought the company, Where To Technologies, and added a keyhole into it. Samuel, you wrote about Google's journey and maps for the site. Who were these two Danes, and what did keyhole do?
So these were two brothers, and they had a dream of a map that was not static, one you could move around and could be displayed basically in a web browser. They were web app people. They came from kind of a programming computer science background, and they had this idea to just basically make, to be honest, it looked like Google Maps, or at least that's how it was described to me. So they pitched this idea to Google. Google went, oh, wow, yeah, okay. And as Google does with its mountains of cash, bought them.
So even in 2004?
Well, it was only a two-man company then, so, possibly a bit cheaper. But they also bought Keyhole. So Keyhole was effectively what became Google Earth. So if you think about the program side of it, it was a globe that you could map. Literally maps were bound to it, but also satellite images and things like that. And you could spin it around and zoom in and away you go. But that was an app version. So effectively, the two companies married quite well together because Keyhole specialized in the satellite side of things. And kind of like the Danes, they brought the kind of web app, kind of static map, the map tiles to it. So the two were married together and became a 50-person team that basically created the first Google Maps.
I remember my first experience with knowing that Google was in this space was Google Earth. That was the thing. Literally, people just, they were like, have you seen this amazing thing, Google Earth? Oh my goodness. And at the time, I was still using sort of Street Finder or whatever mapping service. I was MapQuest at the time that was particularly popular. So was Google Earth the way in? Is that how they got people in?
Well, you see, Google Maps launched in the US first in 2005, and Google Earth came later. They didn't make Google Maps as we know it today for the UK and the rest of Europe until later in 2006. So perhaps people's first interaction with something that was radically different, this globe that you could spin, was Google Earth. And Keyhole had similar products before, but not quite as comprehensive.
It was absolutely extraordinary. But this wasn't the first mapping service on the web.
No, I mean, in fact, the first map on the web came in 1993. Basically, it came from CERN. They just invented the internet. So, well, what do you do with it? You stick on a map. But it was a much more basic system. It wasn't anything that we know or look at today. You put in a set of coordinates, it gave you a map for that coordinates.
When it comes to Google Maps, was it an easy ride? And the reason I ask that is the recent launch, relatively recent launch of Apple's Maps in the last couple of years. They have not had an easy ride. People have really been picking on them for ages and ages, sort of picking them apart. But did Google have an easier ride of it when they came into this space?
Well, Google basically built on the kind of, they weren't the first to create a web app map. By the time they actually launched in 2005, Yahoo had beat them to it. And so they had a kind of a template. They'd already know what they were doing and where to technology source already had a pretty firm idea of what was going to happen. They bought the data from others. See, originally Google basically sequestered data from others, mixed it together. It wasn't just one source. And then as they got better and better and better, they overlaid satellite imagery. They had people tweaking the maps, and then eventually they created their own map data. But it wasn't until Street View launched that they really started going, because they were sending basically sensor equipped surveyors on wheels flying around roads and things like that. So the GPS, the track and everything contributed to their own maps, and they eventually created their own maps.
We're going to talk a bit about Street View in just a second, but before we do, I want to speak with you, Gary Gale. You've been involved in digital mapping and in the location space since, well, for a long time, for 20 years. You're now working with the OS, the Ordnance Survey, as their head of APIs. Welcome to the podcast. My first question is the same question that I asked Sam there. Google wasn't the first mapping service. Did they have an easy ride of it? Did they add anything to, you know, to what was already out there? Was there anything unique about Google Maps, or was it just their accuracy?
I think Google Maps is probably more important than most people think, although probably not as important maybe as Google would like to think. As you've already mentioned, it wasn't the first maps on the web. It wasn't even the first notion of being able to search in human language for maps on the web. But what they did do was they put it in front of so many people. And all of a sudden, you didn't have to be a map geek and be able to speak fluently in geographical coordinates. All of a sudden, you could start to search in ways in which people in the real world do. So you didn't have to give a postcode, a house number. And when Street View first came out, it was a little bit the same as when mobile phones started to come out, which were smartphones, which had maps on them. And people were scratching their heads going, "You know, why on earth would you want to do something like this? I have a paper map. I don't need a map on a small screen." And then you took a look at one of these Google Street View cars, and it's like, okay, fine, there's cameras on that. I get that. They're looking at Street View, street side imagery. But what about all of these other cameras, the ones which are looking up, the ones which are looking down? And myself and several others in the industry at the time said, well, they're making their own map. And sure enough, about 18 months later, when in North America at first, the license renewal came up with TeleAtlas to get the North American data, Google said, thanks, guys. It's been nice. We don't need you anymore.
Ouch. That must have hurt the pockets of TeleAtlas. I can imagine that was a pretty important client for them. Samuel.
I think one of the big turning points for Google Maps, coming from, you know, getting into people's pockets or hands, was actually the launch of the iPhone. Now, and at the time, Google and Apple were buddy-buddy partners. Now, we know today that they fight tooth and nail over some things, that's for sure. I mean, for instance, Apple Maps is exactly that. But you see, I spoke to John Hankey, who was basically Google's head of its geo division until 2011. And he told me that Steve Jobs saw that maps were going to be important to the smartphone and personally phoned him at his desk, wouldn't tell him what was going on, but got him on board to create the first Google Maps app on the iPhone and make it so it was ready for launch. You know, it was that kind of going from a computer screen or a paper map to having a smartphone with sensors in it, things like GPS, mobile data, being able to just have the map wherever you are and not get lost. That was a massive turning point, and I think that's pretty much propelled maps everywhere.
So, Sam, both you and Gary have spoken or alluded to Street View. So they changed the game. Google changed the game again in 2006 with the launch of Street View. How did it happen?
So originally it was Larry and Sergey's idea. So Sergey Brin and Larry Page, Google co-founders. So basically they were driving around Stanford campus, taking pictures out the window in a car and trying to stitch the things together. Basically the idea of, you know, photographing the real world so that you could sit in an armchair and see it. But it took a partnership with researchers at Stanford to actually make it happen, because they were thinking, you know, these cars, you're going to have to send quite a few of them out. So the partnership allowed them to shrink down the technology and massively scale it. And then they literally sent a fleet of these cars with a big kind of bulbous camera on the top and sensors equipped all over the place along the roads.
Alex, how do you think Street View has changed our relationship with maps?
It's an odd one, because it's, in a way, it's sort of reduced some of the pressures on cartographers, or if not reduced the pressures, it's meant that when they fail, it's less damaging. It used to be that if you were trying to find a specific location, one of these points of interest that Gary was talking about, if it wasn't put in the map, you know, if someone hadn't physically written or added the metadata into the map to say this kebab shop is here, you were out of luck. Now Street View means you can zoom straight in and see it. In its own way, it's sort of reduced the need for maps to actually try and accurately reflect the territory that they're charting. They can now be the broad overview, which is really what they're best at.
Now, I was slightly glib before when I said that both of you have managed to find your way to the studio from downstairs within The Guardian. But I do know that, you know, that there are noises happening about Google doing internal mapping of buildings and things like that. So
not even noises. It actually already exists. Exactly. On Google Maps, if you go to, typically they're things like shopping centres, airports, train stations, it will quite elegantly realize when you've zoomed into a certain level that you're no longer looking for information about the outdoors and you're trying to ascertain what's happening indoors, and it will gently pop up and give you a selection of the maps of the floors that you want, whether you want to see the first, second or third floor, and show you, for instance, retail units inside, where a departures lounge is if you're looking at an airport. And that works quite well. Obviously, the thing is, right now, it's a fairly labor-intensive process. It's in its own way quite un-Google. It requires them to, from someone, get a floor plan of a place, pretty much manually upload it, and choose, you know, which locations they want to have internal maps for. One of the ideas they did have is 3D mapping a room, as in you wander in, wave around your Android phone with four cameras on the back and a very, very accurate gyroscope, and you have not even really a map. I mean, it's at this stage where that definition breaks down, but you have a 3D model of the room. Do that for a whole building, you have a 3D model of the building, which is, you know, kind of the platonic ideal of maps.
Gary, you've heard from Alex on his opinion, his perspective on, you know, why Street View has changed our relationship with maps, and also what might happen in the future in terms of, you know, 3D mapping of inside spaces. From the OS's point of view, and even perhaps from your own, is 3D first-person perspective important, or is it just a gimmick?
I think I'm going to put my own hat on for this.
Whose hat have you been wearing?
I wear many hats. I think at the moment, 3D is a gimmick in terms of visualization. I think in terms of having data which has 3D attributes in it is very, very useful and is going to be able to give us the next step of accuracy. One of the panel there said that Street View is reducing the map to a backdrop, to a wallpaper. I'd argue that maps are used for a lot more critical path tasks. For example, if I'm ill in bed and I want an ambulance, would I want somebody to use Google Street View in order to work out how to get to me? Probably not. I would much rather that they're using a mapping application which not only knows precisely where my house is on the street, but also, is there a path which they need to get to my front door? Are there steps? Do I live in a block of flats? Are there lifts? All of these things, which for a consumer use, kind of aren't as important. But when you've absolutely, definitely, 100% got to get people to the right location, they're very, very important. The other thing is, I totally agree that indoor navigation and building 3D models is probably the next generation of where Google and almost every other map maker are going. But it's not just having that model that knows what the inside of a building looks like. It's what happens when GPS doesn't work. And we have enough experience of that in the urban canyons of built-up areas where, you know, our phone or our dedicated GPS device just can't get enough skyline to lock on to those satellites, and so it falls back to Wi-Fi positioning.
Gary, before we continue this, we've spoken quite a lot about literally locations and how maps are related to, you know, where an object is, or, you know, a kebab shop, Alex, as you said, or a person is on the map. But maps don't just convey that kind of information. They convey all different other kinds of information. And we will get on to that shortly, but now a word from our sponsor.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Professor Mark Graham is a senior research fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute, who has looked at the geographies of the internet, and particularly how platforms like Google Maps have reconfigured how people engage with the city. Mark, welcome to Tech Weekly. Google makes some locations visible while rubbing others off the map. You've written quite a bit about that. What does that mean in practice?
We use Google as a way to find things on the map. So we can see Google as a tool that represents part of our world to us. And then if we see Google as a tool that represents part of our world to us, we can ask questions about what it's representing and what it's not representing, what it leaves off the map and what it includes on the map. But we could also see Google as something very different. So if we see the cities that we live in, the world that we live in, as something that's not just represented by Google, but rather if we see the digital as something that's part of the city, then we're forced to see Google as part of the city itself. So the city's not just bricks and mortar, the city's bricks and mortar in information. Now, this has important implications for how we think about our cities, how we think about who controls our cities, who has access to our cities, who has power in the cities that we live in.
And also for our sense of being in the city, of being part of the city, because then surely we become part of that information landscape as well, do we not?
We become part of the information landscape, but I suppose it always depends on who the we is. So some people are more a part of the informational landscape than others, and some places, some businesses, some institutions, some processes are much more central nodes in those networks, and some are far more likely to be peripheries. And again, I think then the key question is to ask, well, who is it that decides who and what and where is visible and who and what and where isn't? And at the moment, it's all a bit opaque.
Now, in conversations that you and I have had in the past, you've mentioned that you have a problem with thinking of the web as a place, as cyberspace, as having any kind of, I suppose, physical attributes, even though we call things home pages, etc. Why? Why do you struggle with this? Because I find it difficult to not see that.
Well, I think we shouldn't think of the web as another place, because quite simply, it isn't. The internet, the web, and our interactions that are mediated through it are precisely that. They're interactions that are mediated through a network, and they all happen somewhere. The wires are somewhere, the people are somewhere, the information is somewhere, the servers are somewhere. And I think if we start thinking about the web as some sort of cyberspace, as something that's both ethereal and ephemeral and somewhere else, we almost shirk our responsibility to ask real, grounded, geographical questions about the social, the economic, and the political, and even the environmental impacts of what's going on.
Something which I think is quite a good example of what you're talking about and might help clarify is the debate over the Hollywood sign on Google Maps, which is kind of a wonderful example of how issues of control of real space make their way into digital maps. And the issue is that if you go on Google Maps and search for the Hollywood sign, it will not take you there. It will point blank refuse to show you any way of getting to the Hollywood sign. There are trails. There is a road straight up there. There's a hiking trail straight up there. But the thing is, the road's not public. And the hiking trail has no parking spaces, which means that people park in the residential area underneath the Hollywood sign, which is a very wealthy residential area that does not take kindly to cars of lots of tourists turning up there. So they petitioned Google and successfully got Google to recommend that if you want to see the Hollywood sign, if you type Hollywood sign into Google Maps, it will instead take you to a viewing area a couple of miles away from where you can stand and see a very small version of the Hollywood sign far off in the distance. If you want to reach it, you'll have to find your own way. Google won't tell you the buses you can take to get from central LA to walkable distance from the sign. It certainly won't show you where you can park your car near the Hollywood sign to walk up. And so in its own way, it's just removed from a lot of people the ability to do this walk.
So Mark, what other examples, if we look at the kind of the information scape and the physical landscape, are there of, you know, ultimately Google controlling how we view the cities and the spaces that we live in?
There's one example I always use of a very simple search for restaurants in starting in one point in Jerusalem. So I just conducted a very simple experiment, which is I begin the Google search at one location in Jerusalem. I do a search for a restaurant, for the word restaurant in English, and Google Maps, as it does, it directs me to certain parts of the city. There are certain clusters, and it shows me 10 different restaurants, and that's what it does. Now, if I do the same search in Hebrew with the Hebrew word restaurant, it's giving me somewhat different restaurants, but in roughly the same parts of the city, the same streets, so it's not really telling me to go somewhere else. If I do the same search in Arabic, it's directing me to a very different part of the city. Now, we can come up with reasons why that's happening, that those restaurants have websites in different languages, they're appealing to different audiences, and Google is just responding to human needs of different audiences. However, there's still a certain amount of opacity there that we should question, because you might even call this a sort of digital ghettoization of the city, in which it's directing some people to certain parts of the city and other people to other parts of the city. We can see that happening all over the world in all manner of examples.
Gary, I'd like to bring you back in and ask how, with your ordnance survey hat on, how you are dealing with that particular problem, your role effectively as the editor of the landscape that people traverse.
If you go onto a search engine right now, it doesn't have to be Google, it could be Bing, it could be Yahoo, you will get different results to the results that I get. And that will be based on the geolocation of the computer that you're typing the query into. It will be based on search history and give you what it thinks is going to be the right response for you. And the more contributing factors that you add into that mix of what constitutes the right answer, the more you actually get away from the geographical accurate answer, more to the algorithmic, I'm trying to be helpful regardless of whether you want me to answer. What's being said that, you know, different results, meaning that different areas of a city almost fall off the map, that's the unfortunate side effect of these algorithms maybe trying to be a little bit too clever, or maybe the algorithms designers need to cut down on the coffee or get out into the real world a little bit more.
Samuel, to wind up, as you were the inspiration for this week's theme on Tech Weekly, please, what do you have to say for yourself?
It is worth remembering that all of these mapping services that we've mentioned so far, so like Google, for instance, or Bing Maps, or even Apple Maps, they're all advertisers. Google makes its money through advertising. People pay for adverts, people pay for positioning on maps. And so when you search for a restaurant, for instance, if one has paid for it, it's going to be ranked higher than any other. And that it's worth bearing in mind that you're viewing a lens through an advertiser.
Well then, the search for a true map continues. Thank you very much to all my guests, Gary Gale and Professor Mark Graham. To the team here in the studio, Samuel Gibbs and Alex Hearn. And thanks to our producer, Alana Chance and Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratowski. We will be back next week. If you miss us, go to theguardian.com/technology. We'll be there.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.